any Jewish newspaper over the last 10, 15 years and tried to count the issues of controversy that have emerged, I think one would discover that an unusually high percentage have to do with issues having to do with women and Judaism. And one would suggest that this would be one of the burning issues of our day, one of the issues that often divides communities, right? Often, if you think both within the Orthodox world and the Orthodox world vis-a-vis the broader Jewish world, often some of the dividing lines have to do with issues pertaining to women. I think this is, just to give you one example, it's very pronounced, I think, actually, in the right-wing conservative world, right? Those conservative Jews who are care greatly about halakhic observance, often the thing holding them back from moving over to Orthodoxy would be the desire for a more egalitarian approach to women's issues. Certainly, this is a burning issue of the day in many ways, and worthy of an afternoon of conversation. I would like to say one thing before I start, which is, I think often important to realize in these issues that Judaism and the Torah didn't like create some of these dilemmas. Often we think like, oh, because we're Jewish, we have all these dilemmas. I think these are questions that are ubiquitous in the world. It's an issue, let's say, of balancing raising a family with career or women's role in leadership positions. Certainly are questions that can be asked even if one is not an Orthodox Jew. And again, I don't mean that we don't have our own unique perspective on these issues, and certainly with the... Certainly are the specifics of our tradition create their own dynamic, which we'll get to in a second. But nevertheless, basically, this is an issue that all of modernity has to deal with, right, including us. Let me start by categorizing. My wife always makes fun of me for needing to list three things or four things. She always say, like, I'll say there are four things before I've even thought of the fourth point. But this time I actually did think of the four of them before it. Okay, so let me just categorize the issue, like where the conflict seems to come up. One of the areas the conflict seems to come up is in Jewish ritual life, in performing a mitzvot. Right, there are also in some of the controversial issues have to do with what can women do, what should women be encouraged to do in the world of mitzvot. If one thinks of, let's say, some of the debates again the last 20 years, let's say women's tefillah groups is one issue that's been debated. Okay, so that's the area of ritual life, just as a category. Second category debate seems to come up is in the world of education and learning. Right? What kind of educational opportunities should be available to women? What should the emphasis of their education be like? Obviously, the issue of Gemara learning for women comes up. Right? So let's posit that as a second category. Third category might be called leadership roles. Right? What leadership roles will be available for women? What role will they have on the shul board or on a communal organization like the OU? Or even in the closer to home, let's say, closer to home in my case in a very direct way, let's say if women become expertise in a certain area of halakha, will they be able to render decisions on this? Right? Just for those of you who don't know, my wife did the two-year Nishmat program, which studies Hilcho Nida intensively, and then is able to answer Nida questions from women. So this is that kind of role for women, like what place does that have in our community? So let's call leadership, we'll call the third one. The fourth issue, I would say, is perhaps the most broad. I mean, we've had mitzvot, ritual, we've had learning and education, we've had leadership. Perhaps the fourth place is really just views of women in general. Right here, one might talk about different mamarei chazal, that you talk about women being like this or women being like that. Some more praiseworthy, some seeming, to our perspective, more denigrating of women. And in general, how we think about what a woman is and what her role in the world is. That would perhaps be a fourth category that's quite broad. Okay, so now we have the categories. Two more opening points, then we'll get to each category individually. I guess I'll tell the first category. I'll start with a story, another story from my wife. My wife was once having a conversation with an egalitarian, a person who felt themselves morally committed to the value of egalitarianism. So my wife said, I'm curious, when you get to Birkat Kohanim during davening, do the women go up also and bless the community? And the person with a little smile said to my wife, what are you talking about, meaning we're egalitarian, we don't have Kohanim. Right, no one gets up to bless the community. That would be anti-egalitarian. Now, I'm only quoting that story to make the following point, which is I think both halachically and hashkafically, the Torah does not agree with this person. Might be a very fine person, but we're not committed to that kind of egalitarianism. We're not committed to everybody has to have the same ability to do everything all the time. Now, I don't mean to overdo the comparison between the Kohen issue and the women issue. I would suggest that when there's no Beit HaMikdash, women have greater reasons for frustration than non-Kohanim. So I don't think the parallel is exact. But at the same time, just to further the point, I think that's something that has to be said right away. We don't feel that we are religiously or morally compelled, that everyone always has to have equal opportunity all the time. And I don't think that we should feel like there's something immoral about that. I mean, I think we should feel that every Jew or every human being should have significant spiritual potential and various means of realizing that potential. But that's not the same as saying every opportunity has to be open to everybody all the time. So I think that's something that should be said right off the board. Okay, with that, I think we can get to the four... one last preface. Sorry, I'm starting to turn into one of my Rebbe's here, having a half an hour preface before we get to the topic. Okay, one last preface. It's clear that issues of women and Judaism have changed, and I think they've changed for almost everybody in the Orthodox community. Right, this is not something that's limited to modern Orthodoxy. If one takes the average, let's say, Haredi girl today, be it in Brooklyn or Bnei Brak, and compares her with her ancestor of 200 years ago, I think it is very difficult to argue that they are getting the exact same education. Right, the whole institution of formalized learning through high school, and let's say in America, many students then going on to spend a year in Israel learning, which is true in the Haredi world also. This was certainly not done in Galicia in 1782. This is not the norm, or let's say even some of the working opportunities that women have. There's, of course, a famous paradox in the Haredi world that often the women are more out there in the working world than the men, if the men are still in Kollel. This, again, might be somewhat of a shift. Now, I don't say this to win points. This is not like to win points against the Haredim that, ha, you've changed also. That's not the point. The point is merely that somehow there's been a shift in educational approach, and for the broad majority of the Jewish community, there seems to be an understanding this way it has to be, that something has shifted, and therefore things can't be exactly as they were, which, of course, obviously opens up the question of what can change in Torah Judaism. So here I think there's two things that obviously can't change. One is the halachic system. Right? We have a system. Right? We'll talk about change within that system, but the system is locked in. And of course, Ikrei Emunah, our fundamental beliefs, are not going to change either. Right? We believe the Torah was given by the Ribono Sholem, that it's mechayavas and mitzvos, there's reward and punishment in the world. These are things that are not subject to change. Right? So we have a halachic system, we have Ikrei Emunah. Within that, there are certain realms of flexibility. For example, certain agadic issues are not pinned down to the nth degree. Like, arguably, in education, there is no one model for how the Torah high school is supposed to look. Right, one goes to Jewish sources, one will see various approaches to educational issues. Right, this is not something that necessarily there's a definitive model. Even with halacha, that my example just now was a non-halachic example. Even in halacha, there's avenues for change within the system. Right, just to use the classic example that always gets tossed around, let's say Prizbal. Right, clearly Prizbal didn't exist. At one point, Shemitah was supposed to cancel all loans. Then Prizbal, Hillel made an institution called Prizbal, which enabled people to not cancel the loan Shemitah times. There's no doubt that's an innovation. Okay, but I would say that's an innovation within the system. It's an innovation within the system for the following reasons. A, it's using a mechanism that the system recognizes. I'm just going to take one approach in Prizbal for now. You don't want to share on Prizbal. Assuming that Prizbal is using a mechanism called Moser Shtorotav LeBeitin, giving over your shtar to the Beitin, and then the loan is not canceled. So Hillel didn't create a new mechanism. He said, within the system, there's a mechanism for having loans not get canceled. I'm going to just make that the standard. That used to be the exception. I'm going to take that principle within the system and make that the standard. Now, why am I doing that? So another question, I've spoken about this with my shir many times. Halachic change always has to be, there's a good mechanism within halacha and there's good motivation. Right? You have to differentiate between lousy motivation for innovation and good motivation. Hillel had excellent motivation. Right? The Torah set up Prizbal as a means of protecting the poor. Right? They'll be able to get loans, and when Shemitah comes, they won't have to pay them back. Clearly, if no one in Am Yisrael is lending money to the poor, so this institution is not currently serving the role it was meant to serve. And therefore, there's a need, there was good motivation for this takana. So in general, when we're looking at women's issues, I think these are some of the things we should check in, we should look at. Right? There's going to be changes. Right? As I've argued, I think there are changes almost across the Orthodox spectrum. At the same time, we should ask, well, do we have mechanisms for these changes? Right? Are they within the halacha or from without? And secondly, right, do we have good motivation? And here again, I think certain things, the push will be greater than in other things. Okay, now we can finally get down to business here. Okay. I actually had another preface, but I'm not going to do that at this point. We'll leave it out for now. Let us start with the world of ritual. Now here, I think something easy can be said, which is... Actually, no, I'm sorry, I'm going to do the last preface. I need to do it. Okay, we'll go back to the world of ritual in a second. Now, what are the factors contributing to this change, which I've argued is often across the board? So it seems to me there's a couple of factors. One factor is simply that we have a lot more free time than other humans had in history, right? And that free time, by the way, I think is manifest both for men and women. But for a lot of human history, people lived much shorter lives, and taking care of the household, just the basic physical needs, was a pretty all-consuming job, be it churning your own butter or shechting your own chicken in the back, right? Obviously, modern mechanized society has enabled much more time than people ever had before. I've mentioned this in the past. That's why there's a phrase called the leisure class. Like, we didn't really understand that phrase called the leisure class because we all have a lot of free time. But the assumption of the term the leisure class was that the bulk of society didn't really have very much free time, and that was only for like a few aristocrats and wealthy people. But now, clearly, we live longer, thank God. We have a lot more free time. That's going to be manifest both for men and for women, right? There's a lot more time for women to take advantage of educational opportunities that wasn't true in the past. So I think that's one factor. Obviously, there are factors in terms of broader trends in society, right? Women are receiving a much broader secular education than they did in the past. So as a response to that, it seems reasonable to many achronim that they should receive a much broader Torah education. I think one could say that in last point in two ways, and that'll segue into the categories. One could say it kind of in a b'dieved way or a l'chachilu way, right? The b'dieved way to say it would be, well, really, the ideal world, women wouldn't learn very much Torah either. But seeing as now they're learning chemistry and biology and philosophy, so we need to balance that with Torah. But I don't think one has to say it in a b'dieved way. I think one could say it in a more l'chachilu way also, meaning since women are now more involved in intellectual endeavors, they could also take advantage of that to become closer to the Ribono Shel Olam through the avenue of Talmud Torah, let's say. So I think some of those changes, again, there's clearly been a response to those changes, but not all of them need to be phrased necessarily as b'dieved. All right, with all that, we can finally get down to business. Again, our four categories. Let us start with the world of ritual. So the world of ritual, it seems to me that there often is a mistake that there's a focus in the community on the more controversial issues, such as women's tefillah or women getting aliyot. It seems to me we could emphasize opportunities for women in many issues that should not be controversial in the slightest. There are many mitzvot that women should be encouraged to do, and often they're not in the community, which don't involve any halakhic question whatsoever. I'll give you a very simple example, right? Three women are at a meal, and there are less than three men, right? And they all have hamotzi, right? So now, this probably happened to many of us, right? You're at a meal, and someone feels like this is a grand feminist gesture to discuss that the women should make a zimun. It must be like the whiff of the radical about you. If one studies this issue in halakha, one will discover that there are only two halakhic positions, right? One halakhic position is that you are chayiv, the women are chayiv to make a zimun. That is the position of the Rosh and the Gra. The other halakhic position is that women have a voluntary possibility to make a zimun. That is the position, admittedly, of most Rishonim. Now, again, I would never suggest you are somehow religiously derelict if you chose not to avail yourself of this possibility, right? The majority position is that it's a Rishut. But there's no reason in the world why this should be viewed as a radical gesture. And as I've said, in halakha, there are only two possibilities, either that this is a reshut or that this is a chiyuv. Right? It seems to me this is something we could encourage women to do, right? Women who are looking for this kind of religious expression, without at all that being any source of controversy. One other example, I think, for women looking for encouraged ritual growth. Let us talk about davening. Right? As many of you know, many women in the world daven one tefillah a day. Some women are even somecha in a very difficult Magen Avraham and say you don't even need a real amidah. Right? You could just have moda ani in the morning does it. Now, many achronim think that more is demanded. In fact, particularly if you're from an Ashkenazi family, which is true about most of us in the room, just to mention briefly the two famous achronim, the Mishnah Berurah thinks women are chayiv to daven shachris and mincha every day. The Aruch HaShulchan thinks women are chayiv to daven three tefillah a day, shachris, mincha, marv. Now, I admittedly don't know too many women who do that, although my wife is one of them. But it seems to me there's something, again, we should be educationally encouraging, right? Women are looking for more demanding religious life. So this is something we should be teaching our women to do, right? Okay, so maybe at certain times that there's a need for leniency, right? I don't know, arguably the husband's at the law firm and I know three kids are crying, so maybe you'll skip mincha that day. But as a general norm, most days, there should be no reason why this shouldn't be something that's encouraged. The same thing, by the way, in terms of tefillah b'tzibur. Right, it's true that women might not be obligated in tefillah b'tzibur as men are, but tefillah b'tzibur seems to be a broad religious value. Why shouldn't women be encouraged to come daven with a minyan? And here, even if one takes the position that when they have little kids, this is not feasible, which maybe might be a reasonable position, you know, most of a woman's life in contemporary times is not taking care of children. Right. Let's say you have a 16-year-old daughter. Right. So why shouldn't she be going to Shul Shabbos morning? Right. Let's say all the kids are grown up and now you're, thank God, going to live from 40 to 90. Right. You got plenty of time when child rearing is not really a major factor. And it seems to me there's no reason why we shouldn't be encouraging women to be taking advantage of what Tefillah B'Tzibur offers. Right. We think Tefillah B'Tzibur is a good thing beyond whether there's a concrete halachic obligation. Seems to me there's something we should encourage. Now, some of encouraging that, by the way, is what gets spoken about in shuls and schools. Some of it is even a simple thing as shul architecture. Right? Shul architecture often is a message whether you would like women to come or not like them to come. Right? What is the mechitza like some hole in the wall, like either on the upper balcony or... I don't want to use an example because I feel like I'll definitely be criticizing someone if I use an example. But you can imagine for yourselves, right there. I'm sorry? there you go. Right, put it this way, there's an architecture that's welcoming to women, an architecture that is not welcoming to women. Right, it's something to think about. And again, obviously there are other constraints that one has when building a shul, but it certainly should be a value in terms of whether we'd like to encourage women to daven with a minyan. Some other very simple examples. Okay, most mitzvot that women are not chayav in, it's considered a good thing religiously it's a mitzvah for them to do so. Almost all of them, right? Let's say, if you think about the list of mitzvah women are exempt of, with the exception of a couple of them, such as tefillin and tzitzis and arguably Talmud Torah, right? Most of them, it's clearly a mitzvah for women to engage in, right? So things, let's say, like shofar and sukkah and lulav and the like, right? Shofar actually is a good example because there's almost a universal Jewish minhag now that women are makbid to hear shofar blowing in Rosh Hashanah. That's some of the communities taken on. But even a simple thing as sukkah, like often in Israel, like people sometimes struggle with the architecture of their sukkah and they're repested above them. Sometimes the solution is just, well, the men will sit in the kosher part of the sukkah and the women will sit in the pasul part of the sukkah. But all things being equal, most of us are able to produce a sukkah. Maybe it's a little bit more crowded, but we're able to produce a sukkah where there are more kosher spots. That should be a value in the community. Right? We should try to figure out how the women will also take advantage of the mitzvah of sukkah. I think it's true about many mitzvot. So, Till and I have been arguing that there's a whole series of communal values and mitzvot that we could be recommending that it seems to me this should not be controversial in the slightest. Right? Whether it be more davening, or more davening b'tzibur, or making a zimun, or taking on the mitzvot which they're pater from. It seems to me there's a whole avenue here, and many avenues for emphasizing women's mitzvot, which again, I'm not telling you no one will ever think they're controversial, right? I know one particular rabbi who I actually have great respect for who now advises women not to do a zimun. I have to admit my humble opinion that I can't see what the issue should be, right? We need to make distinctions, right? Certain things are not halachic issues. Other things are halachic issues. Of course, this becomes less convincing when one discusses things that are more halachically debatable, right? So here, for example, the issue, the article that's come out recently trying to argue that women should be allowed to get aliyot, I don't want to get into the halachic conversation about what it's based on. I'll just make two points here. It seems to me, A, some of the halachic arguments are quite debatable without getting into the nitty-gritty. Second of all, again, this gets back to what I said before, you always have to ask what kind of motivation, I mean, how important is it? So I would say it's very, again, someone could disagree with the value judgment, but I would say certain things, the push should be greater. It's more important that women should have learning opportunities to meet than women should be able to get an aliyah. I view, just in terms of my own religious life, I'm thinking about, meaning Talmud Torah for me is arguably the essential component of my religious life, or certainly one of the essential components. I frankly am quite happy if I never get an aliyah. Right? But even if you say it's important to me, it's not an essential component of religious life. There isn't reason to feel like lacking that one is somehow cut off from the beauty of Judaism. Right? So again, I'm not saying that no one could ever feel left out, but I am saying one has to differentiate between how important the push is. Right? We should be looking for opportunities, or whether the push is not that strong. But again, as I've argued, I think in the world of ritual, there's a lot of things to focus on where they should not be controversial. Okay, let's move on to the issue of learning. Okay, within the issue of learning, as many of you know, women are not obligated in Talmud Torah, but there is a kiyum mitzvah. At the same time, the position, the Gemara that we seem to paskin like, says that women should not learn Torah Shebaal Peh, should not learn the oral law. Now, this obviously opens up the question about what women should do today. So here, I would like to make a couple of points. Even way before modern feminism, right, the sense that women shouldn't be learning already had all kinds of mitigating factors. For example, many pointed out that, of course, but women still need to know what to do. Right, so learning, which is going to include the oral law in terms of halacha, is going to be crucial, so that they'll simply know what to do. One exception. Secondly, the Ari Yisrael of Yisrael Salanter, I think, is not suspect of radical egalitarianism. He pointed out that women need to learn as part of their search for emuna, part of Avad Hashem. Right? He says this in Ari Yisrael. Right? Certainly, we view learning as not just knowing what to do, and not just a mitzvah in its own right, but something that inspires a Jew to connect himself or herself to the Ribono Shel Olam. So that is an avenue of learning that the Rabbi Yisrael Salanter also thought certainly was obligatory as far as women are concerned. So even on the level of obligation, women perhaps had to learn always to know what to do and to fulfill emunah / avat Hashem. Even in Torah Shebal Peh, there's a sense that in Jewish history there were always exceptions. And this gets back to the point I made before, meaning are you working within the system from outside the system? Part of working within is that even when you innovate, the innovation is based on precedent. And here in terms of women's learning, I would say there's two kinds of precedents. Both the precedents of individual women who were quite learned. Again, it was certainly the minority. It was certainly not the norm, but throughout Jewish history, from the example of Bruri and the Gemara, through the Middle Ages and modernity, there are individual women who are quite learned, many of them even in Gemara. Second of all, there's a halachic position that to base oneself on. Famously, the Rambam says, women should not learn Torah Shebal Peh because rov nashim, the multitude of women, are not able to handle it. So there's a famous position of the Prisha, where the Prisha says, well, if the Rambam says rov nashim, that means if any individual woman shows that she is not from that rov, then there is no issue in teaching her Torah Shebal Peh. Now again, the Prisha phrases it as a minority, but we might say that given contemporary conditions, we should view that miyot is now in itself becoming the rov, right? That now there are more women who don't have an issue either because of greater intellectual opportunities for women in general or whatever argument you will make. But again, the point would be there's an argument to be made within the system, right? That there's precedence, albeit perhaps minority positions, but precedence that one can rely upon to increase opportunities for women's learning. Here again, just to make two more points about learning, I'd say what I said before. Here it seems to me that the motivation should be very high, right? That we view that learning is something that is a great force in connecting someone to Torah and connecting someone to observance. And it's something that the desire to provide opportunities, it seems to me, would be much greater than with something, as I mentioned before, as in women's aliyot. I would just point out one thing. Arguably, that maybe I don't want to get into a long discussion of this, but maybe based on what we said before, maybe one might devise a different curriculum. Right, that actually gets me to Rav Schechter's famous line. Rav Schechter, why he was once asked, should girls' curriculum be more like boys? And he famously answered, actually, boys' curriculum should be more like girls. Right, which gets into the whole question of the dominance of Gemara in yeshiva education, and should there be a broader-based curriculum? So I don't want to get into it because that's a whole other discussion that's worthy of men's yeshiva as well. But that's something we might want to think about. You might want to provide a lot of learning opportunities for women, but maybe the curriculum need not look exactly like a men's yeshiva. Perhaps we'll talk about that some other time. Okay. Leadership was our third category. Again, I don't think we're committed to absolute egalitarianism. I don't think we have to say that all the same leadership opportunities that men have, women will have. I think certainly it's not true in the broader world at this point in time. At the same time, it seems to me there are many things that women can do and should be encouraged to. Even a very simple example. Let's say you run a girls' yeshiva high school. It seems absurd to me that the bulk of the teachers should be male, right? If you're talking about role models, the people they can relate to, people they can talk to about their issues, it seems obvious that it would be easier for a 16-year-old girl thinking about her place in the Torah community that a good woman role model will often be a much better source of information, a much better person to confide in, to talk to, than a man. It seems to me that there's a great example, right? Well, certainly in women's education, there should be a strong amount of women involved teaching or running those schools or the like, right? I have all kinds of family connections lurking in the background here, but my mother was a girls' principal in several high schools in the New York area, and I think many of her students over the years very much appreciated a female role model that they could discuss their issues with. And it seems to me that even a very wonderful male Talmud Chacham in that role might not have been able to provide the same kind of guidance. Again, here, I think one has to, again, pick the areas which are most likely to, where the argument is most convincing. Again, getting back to what my wife does, it seems to me that Hilchot Nida is a particular area of halacha where it makes sense that women should have a certain expertise, where many women find it difficult to ask shilas to male rabbanim, even, by the way, even via their husband, they often find it difficult, which you can talk to your wives or married friends about this. And often the ability to confide in another woman is something that they find very helpful. It makes them feel much happier about halachot of Taharat HaMishpacha, seems to me like we should certainly pick areas like that where there's a very good argument to be made to expand women's leadership roles. So again, I'm not suggesting we should search for radical changes, but again, as I argued in the world of mitzvah, I think there's certain simple steps we can make that on the one hand provide opportunities for women, at the same time don't suggest some radical overhaul of the system as we have. I would like just to throw in one caveat. I think it's important that women's learning be kept in perspective, both as a favor to women also. Meaning, there aren't any women in the Jewish community today who are in the level of learning as Rav Shlomo Zalman Orach or Moshe Feinstein. Now, this is not a failure of women's education, right? There's no reason why that should be the barometer of success. I remember once, I was once sitting at a table with my wife and a few of her friends, and they were talking about women's learning. There was somehow this, one of the women expressed despair that they haven't produced greatness in Torah scholarship yet. And I said to them, you know, like, first of all, learning Talmud Torah is not just about producing greatness. Like, many of us get tremendous amount of things out of Talmud Torah, whether or not we become the next Gadol Hadar. There's no reason that should be the definition of success. Second of all, it's not reasonable to expect, and women don't have those kind of learning opportunities that men have in many ways, without getting into detail. There's no reason to expect that. So, I think we could take much pride and joy in the growing opportunities women have had, but I think things need to be kept in perspective for the sake of the community and for the sake of the women themselves. Okay. The fourth category I had, heading towards the end here, was about various statements in Chazal about women. Here, I would say two things. First of all, as I've said, most of these statements are in the ergodic realm. That doesn't mean that it should be dispensed with chas v'shalom, but it does mean there might be a certain fluidity, there might be different positions being expressed. Indeed, if one goes through Chazal, one will find different impulses about women, right? Some, again, as I said, more praiseworthy, some more negative. I'm not sure that we need to feel that somehow we need to put all these statements together to come up with one coherent picture of what the Jewish view of the woman is. Seems to me that, again, we could emphasize Mamre Chazal about women that lead to a certain positive conception. And I don't know if we need to explain every single Mamre Chazal. I would say one thing, perhaps this is the most, maybe it's the most radical thing I'm going to say today. I don't think it's terribly radical. In general, I'm quite reluctant to historically contextualize Mamre Chazal. I think that's a dangerous position, and I think Chazal, we're not just always limited by their historical context. I couldn't see beyond it. One of the few exceptions where I might be willing to say it is certain perspectives on women's learning. Say when the Gemara says that Ein Chachma Leisha Ela Bepelach, that a woman's wisdom is only in the spinning wheel, I think one might argue that that is Chazal looked around at women of their day, and that was the sociological reality. But no, that's committing us to women for eternity are locked in, that that's the only place they could possibly express intelligence. It just doesn't seem empirically to be true, right? So in a case like that, as a rare exception, where I might say that Chazal are commenting on the women of their time, but not necessarily that this is a locked-in principle of Judaism. Okay, so those are in terms of the four approaches. Now I'd like to make like four or five closing points and sum it up. Okay, I think it's important that when we emphasize growing opportunities for women, we not denigrate the traditional role also. There's often like this tension in the Jewish community. On the one hand, you want to say that women who want to learn more and have more of a public voice should have those means of expression. At the same time, you don't want to be in a community where someone who says, well, yes, girl, what do you do? And she says, well, I watch my kids. You just have to like look bashfully around that that's what she does. It's certainly a worthwhile endeavor, right? And it's not something that women should be denigrated for in the slightest. We should provide a community where there's more than one model of what it means to be a firm Jewish woman, right? Just like there should be more than one model of what it means to be a firm Jewish man, right? There's no reason why we should emphasize that there's only one approach. I'll put that in a nice story. You know, there's always a danger when people quote Rav Soloveitchik stories. So, but this one's too good, so I can't resist quoting it, right? My mother, when she started her first high school, she and my father went to talk to the Rav Soloveitchik about the woman's role and what to tell the girls. So the Rav famously said that, famously for people in my family, the Rav said that there's a concept in halacha of shnei ketuvim amachshishin zedzeh, two psukim that contradict each other. So he said, this is what you have here, right? You have on the one hand the mother's desire to raise her children and spend time with her children. At the same time, the reasonable desire to play a role in the community and give in other ways and have a career and the like. So Rav Soloveitchik said, so that's shnei ketuvim amachshishin zedzeh. So of course we know what's the halachic principle. You wait for the ketuv hashlishi, Shiachriya b'nehem, right? You're looking for the third verse that somehow resolves the dilemma. So, of course, my parents said to Rav Soloveitchik, so what's the third verse? Soloveitchik said, the woman herself. And I think what he meant is that this is a tension that's going to be part of the community, and it's not something that there's a definitive answer to how to navigate this tension. And maybe different women will come to different answers about the tension. And rather than giving a definitive model for how to navigate this tension, perhaps the ideal of an educator would be to talk about the tension and talk about different models for dealing with it. But not that everyone's forced either into a more public career model or a more stay-at-home model. Okay, let me end with a couple more points. Okay, often, I think one thing you have to be careful about, often people raise the question of motivation, right? And often the claim is, well, these women aren't really interested in coming close to the Ribono Shel Olam, they're just interested in making a feminist statement. Now, I can't deny that that might sometimes be true, and I'll talk about when it might be true in a second. I would point out, though, I think you have to be careful, because sometimes you get the sense in the Jewish community that somehow the motivation issue is only raised when women are the ones involved. Somehow men are not suspect of problematic motivations, and I think that's certainly a problem, right? Certainly the same way, if we're going to check every woman's motivation, so perhaps that means that men's motivation need to be checked also. To give you a simple example, when I taught in the Yeshiva Flappish, there was a whole question about whether a girl was going to say Kaddish or not. So the whoever it was decided that she could say Kaddish at the school minyan. So I remember two boys in my class who were not particularly frum, who were going bananas about the fact that this girl was saying Kaddish. And it seemed pretty clear to me that halachic values was not really a major factor in their opposition. Right? There was a means of trying to put this girl in her place, basically. So again, I'm not suggesting that all men have problematic motivations also. That's also a danger, by the way. Many, just to flip it for a second, some feminists talk as if any time they get a no answer, it's just the men trying to put down the women, which is really not fair either, right? The men might just feel that they're following halakhic principles. Right? Not every no is an attempt to put you down. But I think here, in general, I think we should be wary of tossing the motivation card in either direction. Right? The women shouldn't be so quick to say the men are just trying to keep the women in the kitchen. But the men, on the other hand, should not be so quick to say, oh, it's just some kind of radical feminist desire to win points for feminism and has nothing to do whatsoever with Torah. I think especially if one really meets many of the women who are frustrated by these issues, I think one discovers that many of them are authentically striving for some kind of relationship with the Ribono Shel Olam. It's not fair to say it's all problematic motivations. I'm not going to give a checklist for checking anyone's motivation. I'll just mention one thing that might make you suspicious. So again, in general, I think that we should give women the benefit of the doubt. I don't think we should view everything as an attempt to undermine. The one place I get suspicious is, I think a certain person in particular I have in mind, but I don't think anyone will guess it. Let's say if a learned woman only seems to be interested in women's issues, right? Every public shiur they ever give is about pushing the envelope on women's halachot. I think at that point I'd get a little suspicious, right? It's like how come you're not interested in, I don't know, Paraduma or Cheskas Mamon or Adam Zomen or the like, right? That arguably someone who's really attracted to Torah would find that attraction in a broad range of things. Now again, I don't think that doesn't mean they can't specialize in women's issues, right? That might be reasonable, but almost like an exclusive focus on that I would see as a bad sign. But again, as I said, in general, I would be wary of being quick to charge people with problematic motivations. Again, I think just to sum up here, I think that we have to provide different models for women. I think we have to understand that there's a need, again, that the woman of today is not necessarily like the woman of 1200s Europe. But at the same time, it's reasonable. We're a traditional community, right? Traditional community means that we keep traditions. It means change happens slowly. It means we take things, we're not so quick to try to radically turn things over. So this seems to be like, again, obviously there's a whole range of nuances to be said here that can't be articulated, and every case has to be defined on a case-by-case basis. But I think we would, some of the principles perhaps for deciding these things are what I've said before. We need to define need, right? How much is the need to push a bit? We need to find the mechanism, right? Are we working within the halacha? Are we going against the halacha? And we need to figure out how to, on the one hand, provide opportunities for women looking for more religious opportunities, at the same time maintaining the sense of tradition and continuity and fealty to our halachic system.
I feel a little awkward because I'm sure many of you have questions for Rabbi Blau, but I suspect that if he takes the questions right now, there just won't be any time left by the time we finish. So I'm going to speak at this point and try to remember your questions. Maybe you just jot them down very quickly so you remember to ask them. I'm sure they're important. I agree with a great deal of what Rabbi Blau said. I think more than a great deal, the great majority And although there are some things which I might disagree with and do, I'm not going to speak about those points. I'm going to try to focus on a different area or in a different realm. And I hope we're doing this right, that I'm speaking second. Because what I'm going to try to do is to raise problems rather than to provide solutions, which I think Rav Lau did with great finesse and expertise. I want to explain the what might be seen as the problem or a number of the problems of feminism to the limits of my understanding, and explain why I don't see a real solution, at least in the horizon under the present circumstances. And Rabbi Blau may want to comment on what I say afterwards, or he may not want to. He may want to ask me questions, but I'll try to explain myself. Rabbi Blau dealt in the first category with the question of mitzvot. We know that women are obligated to keep many of the mitzvot, that they're not obligated to keep some of them, and that even the ones that they're not obligated to keep, they have the opportunity to keep, by and large, with very few exceptions, and that this is by and large overcome if we simply provide them with the opportunity to do so, as certainly the community has with the mitzvah of shofar, and with a little bit more of an effort can be done with the sukkah as well, and certainly many places it is being done, and so on and so forth. The question is like this. We have a halakha, rather clear, that women are not obligated in mitzvot aseh shehazman grama, in the time-bound mitzvot. There are some exceptions to that rule. Maybe there are some non-time-bound mitzvot that they're also obligated, that they're also not obligated upon. Have we resolved the question or the issue by saying that women have the opportunity to fulfill the mitzvot if they want to? Is it all over? Is it no longer a problem as a result of saying that? And a result of that being the case? If that's so, then it's certainly been resolved. Then by encouraging women to go to shul on Rosh Hashanah, as we certainly do, even if we're not sufficiently encouraging on the rest of the year, and by making sure that the sukkah is big enough for them to sit in, and providing them with a lul of an esrog, as I believe is also done in most, if not all, places, and by encouraging them to study Torah, each community according to its present custom, as Rabbi Blau explained very well, then it's no longer a problem. And following the sheet of Rabbeinu Tam, which is certainly universally accepted amongst the Ashkenazim, and widely accepted amongst the Sfaradim as well, that women can make brachot on performing these mitzvot, then externally speaking, there's no difference at all between men and women on these matters. Yes, there are a few exceptions to the rule. It's tefillin, right? That's not the issue at the moment. By and large, the problem has been overcome. Does it bother anybody that women are not obligated to perform these mitzvot and that men are? That if a woman decides, as many women decide, I like to eat in the sukkah when I want to eat in the sukkah. But if I'm out in town and I want to sit down in a restaurant that doesn't have a sukkah available, I want to take advantage of that as well. And many women I know who very much like to eat in the sukkah in every possible opportunity also are quite pleased at the moment when they are not obligated to do so and have the opportunity to eat where they want and how they want and whatever they want. During Chol HaMoed or whatever, without any problem. If that's not an issue, then great. We're not out to make issues where they don't exist. But if the essential difference between men and women, in that men are obligated to keep mitzvot aseh shehazman grama, and women are not, is perceived as problematic, then the technical overcoming of this matter is not changed. A well-known rabbi in the Tradition magazine about 30 years ago suggested that no doubt a future Sanhedrin would change this halakha. To the extent I'm familiar with with those who would likely be on such a Sanhedrin, let's say, if we were about to set one up today, I can't think of anybody. It would be like, 71 zip against changing this or any of the other things that we're talking about. So the notion that as time goes on, these matters will change and change, at least in an essential way, does not seem to be the case. Now, I for one am not bothered by this distinction that women are not obligated in mitzvot aseh shezman grama and men are, that women are not obligated to study Torah and men are. I think that the reason for this is very, very essential, and that it's based in the different persona of men and women. The notion that there are different persona from men and women in a very essential way, something Rabbi Blau more than hinted to in saying that it's very important that women have personal examples during their Jewish education to look up to and to relate to and to be able to ask their perhaps specifically feminine or female questions or at least hear a feminine or female perspective on the answers to those questions. But the exact definition of what that difference is between men and women, I don't think this is the place for me to talk about what I think it is, and no doubt I'm not exactly right, and I don't expect that anyone is going to be, because this is something that all of humanity seems to be thinking about quite a bit and all the time, and for many centuries and many millennia, I believe. And the exact understanding of what the difference is between men and women and why the spiritual needs might be different from each other is the exact difference is beyond us, apparently. And If whether it's Gzeras HaKasuv in the Torah or whether it's Chazal's interpretation of how these mitzvot ought to be performed, comes out as it being different for men and women, and this is their understanding of how practically these different persona should have their application, it's very hard for us to judge. But it's certainly not egalitarianism, and it comes from a perspective that there must be an essential difference. It's of course very different to say that women are not worthy of those mitzvot than to say women are spiritually superior and don't need those mitzvot, or to say something in between, whatever that in between might be. My own tendency is to understand that women don't need these mitzvot, and whether it's a notion of superiority or not is for anyone to judge. But that there is this difference, and that this difference has consequences, is not something that can really be ignored, and is not something that's about to change. A second point, I think a more troublesome one. There is a halakha that I think has a much more powerful effect on the relationship between men and women in Judaism in regards to the issues of feminism than is usually addressed within these forums. And that halakha is tzniut. Now, when I'm using that term, I don't mean to refer to a very broad notion or a very broad role of saying women should be home, they should be kept in the house, or they should keep themselves in the house, or anything of that sort. That's not what I'm referring to, although you may not agree with me by the time I finish with this. What I am referring to is a simple biological point, and that is the difference between the way men are attracted to women and the way women are attracted to men. This is results in a halakha which is well known to everybody, and that is the general obligation of women to cover themselves much more stringently than men are expected to. In front of women in general, and perhaps even privately. And the assumption seems to be that simple, raw visual stimulation is much more impactful on men than it is on women. I hope I've been clear and that I don't have to be more explicit. My understanding is, although I'm certainly not an expert nor a professional, is that this is an accepted idea within psychology, and that it's not really subject to dispute, and has all sorts of consequences in society in general. And anything which has consequences in society in general is bound to have consequences within the context of halakha. So let's try to understand. A man gets up in front of a group of women. That's not perceived as a provocation in any way. A woman gets up in front of a group of men. Well, that's not exactly the same thing, apparently. The capacity of a woman to divert men's attention from what they might otherwise want to focus on or concentrate on, and to focus simply on them, and on them, I don't mean it in the I-thou sense of Buber, but rather in the I-it sense of Buber, is quite significant. And la'aniyut da'ati, and I know there are many, g'dolim v'chachamim many, who have said otherwise, I think this has a major impact on the issue of women taking public roles, particularly within tefillah, within the synagogue, and perhaps in many other ways as well, to an extent that I would be very, very cautious about limiting the extent to which this has an impact. The question of women receiving aliyot, for example. And the Gemara statement that it's kvod hatzibur that women not receive aliyot, which is a phrase that women quite understandably, or some women, or many women, I don't know, quite understandably, at least have difficulty understanding what that means, or accepting it, and certainly feeling that if this was once so, it certainly isn't anymore, or shouldn't be anymore, and maybe shouldn't have been even then. And that if the tzibur would simply be mochel, as no doubt most fine Orthodox men would be very willingly be mochel this matter, then it's been done away with. On the other hand, if the issue of kvod tzibur over here is to be understood not simply as an issue of don't ask me what else, people, how it's unto be understood. I frankly have a hard time understanding except within the context I'm about to explain. if Kvod HaTzibur in this context is that when a woman gets up to read from the Torah, men might be listening more to her voice. Let's try to remember that originally Aliyot were given for people to read actually, and not merely to say the blessings. But if we were to get up and to read the Aliyot, or even sing the Brachot, or perhaps even state them, if the focus of the congregation, or of the men in the congregation, would be perhaps more on the woman, more on how she looked, more on her voice than on what that voice was saying, that would certainly be a denigration of Kvod HaTzibur. We're asking the Tzibur to overcome a certain biological response to what's going on and say, no, naughty boy, focus on Asher Bachar Banu Mikol HaAmim. Focus on the Aseres HaDibros. Focus on whatever is being read. Don't look at the girl. Don't look at the woman. Don't look at what she's wearing. Don't look at what she's not wearing. If that's what Kvod HaTzibur is about, then, and I think it is, let me be 100% clear, then it's silly to say that we could be mochel such a thing. We may be able to be mochel our dignity, but we can't really be mochel the way we are. By the way, without a shadow of a doubt, men are different in this way, one from another, in the extent to the response they have in this distraction. There are undoubtedly men, perhaps some, or maybe many of you here, who don't understand what I'm talking about, or at least not to the extent that some of the others of you do. And exactly to what extent or what level this is an issue for any particular individual, the halakha deals with the community as a whole. And this is something that can't be overcome. Now, I'm familiar with a contemporary attitude in the secular world to this issue. That contemporary attitude is, men have a problem, so they have a problem. Let them learn to deal with it. I'm not in a position to evaluate the legitimacy of such a view from a secular perspective. There's no question that the halakha does not take that approach. The approach of the halakha is, men are different than women in this way, women are different than men in this way, the halakha is going to take recognition of it, and does. It certainly does in the questions of tzniut, and how men and women respectively dress in each other's company. My sense is that to whatever extent publicity for women is either forbidden within a synagogue context or perceived as not as desirable within some other context, whatever that context may be, is heavily affected and impacted by this notion. This is not something that's going to change. And it's not something that I can say is fair. But the notion of fairness within this context is meaningless. Lahavdil, there are those of us who are stronger just physically, and those of us who are weaker. Though there are those of us who have greater potential for memory and understanding, and those of us who have less, each of these things are going to afford us different opportunities within our lifetime, have, are, and will. This difference between men and women is a fact. It's a fact, apparently, in the way God created the world. And in that sense, God created the world in a non-egalitarian fashion. Not that this is an egalitarian issue. Not at all. Of course, feminism can come down very strongly in favor of the point I'm trying to make, or that the halakha actually comes across with on many of these matters. And there the halakha stands very strongly together with feminism in not using women as baits to buy Coca-Cola or a particular new car or whatever else. Something which, of course, you all know better than me, goes on all the time. And no one seems to be doing very much about it. The use of women in this I-it way is wrong. It's halachically wrong. I'll take it a step further. It's halachically wrong to use this kind of method to draw people closer to Judaism. And it's wrong when it's used, and I know that it's used, and it's wrong when it's used in this way. But the if it's not just a question of the use of lack of tzniut for commercial purposes, but a realization and a recognition of the fact that within a religious context, or in general, men are affected by these things, and lahalacha deserve a certain amount of protection, and I want to emphasize, only a certain amount of protection. First of all, the Yetz is something that we're mekarev b'yamin u'merachek b'smol, it's not something that we push aside completely, but beyond that, men do have a personal responsibility in this matter. And it's not something that can be just shoved completely as the woman's responsibility. But having said all that, to some extent, men are lahalacha granted a certain protection from being overly provoked. Again, the term provoked is not an intentional term on the part of the women, or at least need not be, but is simply a matter of fact in terms of the way men receive this stimuli. And it's something that that has to be dealt with. It's not really going to change. We could change the standards, but or maybe we can't, but we are the way we are. Men are the way men are, women are the way they are in this way. It's not a question of being better or worse, it's a question of being different. And the results from this is something that men and women end up having to live with in all sorts of ways. For the bulk of human history, this was taken for granted, apparently, and by society at large, and not subject to debate or questioning. Today in the Western world, that's not the case. I don't know if it's going to ever change, the Western world, I mean. But I'm quite sure that the focus that the Torah perspective on demanding a refraining from licentiousness in our personal habits is such that our goals are completely different than the rest of society. This is a very basic point. I don't know for sure the way the world was 100 years ago, 200 years ago, but we're told that, at least on the front of things, things were quite a bit more tsanua. today, if a woman would dress in a certain way or present herself in a certain way, and if men found it provocative, the question would be, well, so what? He said, well, it makes all sorts of feelings. He says, so what's going to happen from these feelings? Well, such and such might happen from these feelings. Well, so what if such and such happens? That's not an issue. Okay. If it's not an issue, then I guess it's not an issue. But for religious Jews, relationships between men and women is an issue. It's a very serious issue. Yeah. Our notion of marriage is very clear. A notion of what relationships are meant to be like, to whatever extent they could be before marriage, is also clear. And setting up society whereby the goal is, in a certain way, to have a certain kind of a premarital situation and a different kind of marital situation, and the uniqueness of the marital situation calls for a tzniut that the secular world is not interested in, doesn't commend, quite the contrary, talks against, and we're just not going to meet their standards. We don't want to, al PMS. They don't want to meet our standards either, al PMS. And the result is that we don't exactly fit in. And if we don't exactly fit in, then we're living in a tension. Because I and Rabbi Blau, like the rest of you, live in the modern world and want to live in the modern world, want to avail ourselves of a great many of its opportunities, and even more so of the tremendous scientific and sometimes humanistic knowledge that it presents. And yet we want to incorporate it into our Torah lifestyle and not have the secular perspective take over. And that being the case, I don't think we can expect to be able to meet the standards. In other words, I don't mean to say only what Rabbi Blau made very clear, that there are certain things that can change based on the notion of religious authority. I don't mean to repeat that, and Rabbi Blau made that as clear as could be made. But I think beyond that, or at least together with that, it's not just a question of technical authority. It's that the ultimate goal of what the relationship is between men and women, or men and women, is meant to be, is different from the Torah perspective in our tradition than from the secular perspective. And that's going to result in a different balance in all sorts of ways between men and women, and that will be powerfully, and is powerfully, impacted by the way men relate to women as opposed to the way women relate to men. And a great deal of the results of that is halacha. Because while a great deal has changed in society over the past 3,000 years, very little has changed in biology. Very little has changed in men and women, and in how they react and interact with each other. This is what I would like to add to what had been said before, and I'll stop now, and I guess both Rabbi Blau and myself are open to questions.
Look, I would say three basic things. I've thought of all three already. First of all, it's clear in Jewish thought, if one reads the Rishonim, that Hashem is neither male nor female. So it's a literary problem rather than a abstract theology problem, right? It's equally wrong to say that God is male as to say that God is female. Right? Again, it still opens the literary question up, but just in terms of our conception of the Ribono Shel Olam, right, really doesn't have a gender. So that's the first thing I would say. I think the Rishonim are absolutely clear about that. The second thing I would say is I don't think one has to explain that Hashem is phrased in the male because males are better, and therefore we like to associate God with the better gender. I think it's very simple that in Tanakh, one element of divinity that's supposed to be manifest is divine kingship. And I would say, for most of human history, but I guess for all of human history, right, the gender that best conveys the commanding voice of the monarch would be the male gender. So again, you might say that there might be other aspects that be conveyed otherwise, but it seems to me that from the Torah's perspective, that's what it was most concerned with, that aspect. That aspect of the Ribono Shel Olam come through, and therefore it chose the male gender. I will point out, this is the third thing I would say, that in certain Kabbalistic sources, there is a sense of the feminine aspects of divinity as well. Right, so that's something that many moderns have found quite reassuring, that there'll be both, I'm not an expert of Kabbalah, but that there's the element of Shechina, which is phrased in the feminine as well. So that's, I guess, the third thing I would say. But again, even according to that third point, the reality is that God is neither male nor female. I think that would be the most important point, moving it from an abstract question to just a literary question. Do you want to add anything, Rabbi Shair? Okay.
Is the second issue a sociological issue, you would say?
About responding to the commanding voice of the monarch?
Yeah.
Look, I don't think you have to answer that question necessarily, meaning whatever that is, I think that has been true for all of human history. I think today it's true also. I mean, I think with all of modernity, like how many countries have had world leaders who were female? So thinking today, like we would associate more the voice of a monarch with a male voice. So I think that would be the explanation I would think I would focus on. Yes, Gabe.
The perspectives that you've proposed, would you see them imagining a world where they would kind of all be accepted, where everybody would encourage what you said it should be more encouraged, emphasize what you said would be more emphasized. Would you see that world at equilibrium, where suddenly everybody's comfortable, or would things be more or less tense?
Okay. Gabe's making a fine point, which I think Rabbi Shea was trying to convey also, which is even if we lived in the ideal universe I painted and let's say no one in the Jewish community would give trouble to any of the avenues that I thought were good and positive and legitimate avenues for women's religious growth, would everybody be happy? I would have to concede no. Right.
But would there be more or less, there would be more or less tension? Would there be more tension because the poignant issues would be more obvious? Or would there be less tension because people would be satisfied with what they have?
I would say, first of all, I think there'll be less tension, but I would say more important than the question whether there'll be more or less tension will be that the women will have the opportunities for religious growth that is important to them. Meaning that could go along with certain frustrations, but I think that's in value in its own right. And I would argue that there'll be less tension ultimately. That some of the tension comes from women being discouraged from doing things that are really totally legitimate within the tradition. You're right, those who want absolute egalitarianism are never going to be satisfied. That's true. But I don't think they would get more frustrated when we encourage women to do A, B, C, D and stop at E, F, G. I don't think that would be a greater source of frustration. I think, again, as Rabbi Shrader pointed out, that's just tension between us and modernity, which is not a gap which cannot be bridged. I think it's an unbridgeable gap. Okay?
I have a question for Rabbi Shrader. You mentioned in talking about tzniut that there are there's a certain physiological relationship between men and women that the way men perceive women that is somehow cannot be changed. It's just sort of a physiological fact. And my also only by very limited understanding of the way current science understands things is that that's true, that there is a physiological a nature side to things in the way that men are stimulated by women, but that there's also a nurture side to things. And so that in a society where men are not accustomed to seeing women in roles and seeing women around a lot, they are more affected by that, for example, in a society maybe from several hundred years ago. But that that there's also a nurture side to it, that in a situation or in a society that where men are more accustomed to seeing women around and more accustomed to having them present, that they are less affected physiologically in that attraction simply because of the socialization they've been with this. So do you think that we can take this into account based on our own society, where women are simply more present, they are in more leadership roles, they are more seen?
I don't know. Maybe. I have to admit that it's hard for me to buy. And I'll try to explain. The outcome of what you've suggested is that in more mixed societies, there would be greater chastity. I haven't heard that that's the case. There seems to be very little to indicate that as a result of men and women hanging out together, they don't, they're not as attracted to each other. The people who go to mixed beaches, just stops affecting them after a while. And I just haven't heard that that's... I understand what you mean, that... But I think to the extent to which it's true is of an extent insignificant ultimately in terms of the halachot. I of course can't prove what I'm saying, and that leaves me open to being debated. But again, all the suggestions that if you put women and men together enough, then they don't affect to each other anymore, is counterindicative to the theory of evolution and to the experience we have in our own society. And I have a hard time with it, but I understand what you're saying. To me?
I have a question that I think is broad, but I want to focus on a specific issue as an example. Rabbeim and halachic authorities have encounter very often much more explicit material, let's say. Encounter sometimes intimate details of other people's private lives, intimate details which later on they encounter the people involved face to face in other situations, etc. This, I guess, demonstrates from the halakhic perspective that there are roles of responsibility which have a greater propensity or a greater ability to for the people in those roles to show self-restraint in the biological issues that you brought up. What direction do we go in those issues? Do we say, well, how much can we encourage that and recognize it as a potential in men, or in men as their learning increases, or as their responsibility increases? Or do we go in the other direction and say, well, maybe now we have greater opportunity to take those roles out of the hands of men and put them in the hands of women, so that we have less michshols in front of the male halachic authority?
Let me restate what you said, and tell me if I understood you correctly. You were referring specifically to what Rabbi Blau was talking about in terms of Yod Sod for Luchot Nida?
It's just as an example. Let's say Hilchos Nida. Rebbeim that are asked these questions are exposed to much more explicit details to other people's personal lives. And they're expected to be able to handle it.
Yeah. Again, speaking as a non-psychologist, there is no frame of halakha in which Rabbanim or Poskim are exposed to a women's body in a physical way, in an explicit way. The exception which is dealt with heavily in halakha is when a woman has to go to mikveh for gerut and the requirement of bezdin there, and you can see the various solutions to the problem by looking up the poskim. I don't plan on going into it right now, but Shiyeh Barur that there are solutions to the problem, and men don't see women literally going to mikveh, so to speak, in that context either. So since we're not dealing with absolute visual stimulation, I don't think what you're saying is that relevant. I think you're exaggerating the concern. I don't know. I mean, of course, the question is a much more real question in a way for a doctor or for a gynecologist. I'm not familiar with the literature on what takes place within that context. My assumption is, and there are halachot along these lines also, is that when a person is dealing with a matter in a professional way, this is also implied in the end of the Maseches Kiddushin, as I recall, then it's assumed that the professionalism takes over and that the person has the capacity to set aside the personal issue. Of course, you're dealing there with the professional, not with the mass. And to say that everybody who goes to shul is a professional, well, I don't think that that's the case. I hope not, at least. I have my own concerns, to be quite frank, about the assumed halachic permissibility of a male lifeguard for women swimmers. Any lifeguard I've heard from has not contradicted my concerns. In terms of doctors and gynecologists, I've spoken to them as well. You're free to also, and you can get mixed kind of things. When you're not dealing with actual visual stimulation, it's different. In terms of the problem of Rabbanim being approached on personal matters, the way psychiatrists or psychologists are sometimes approached on personal matters as well, and thereby take in the confidence of women, it could be a very problematic matter. It has been a very problematic matter, and it's no simple thing. Rachmana Litzlan, there have been a very few number of rabbis who have abused their position in this way. And they and their those who have come to them for help and the community at large have suffered terribly from those unfortunate events. And you're absolutely right. On any case where a woman could feel just as comfortable speaking on these personal kind of things to women as opposed to a Rav, it should be encouraged. Having said that, there are Rabbanim and male psychologists and male psychiatrists who deal with these things very, very well. And I wouldn't want the community of women to lose out on their expertise, each one in his own way, because of this concern. Again, dealing with upright people who deal appropriately with these matters. And the issue there is not visual stimulation, or at least not exclusively that. It's usually taking women in and abusing them in a way that is very unfortunate. For me?
It seems to be that we have to assume about communities who raise these issues without formulating a shkafa that you presented, either one of two options. Either one, that they're unaware of this possible perspective and so on, or number two, they're aware of it but are not interested in cultivating this perspective as part of their Yiddishkeit. From both of the first question I would ask is for the first group who are not aware of it, but well, what would be some of the educational models that we would have to inaugurate in order to teach them? And the second model is for those people who are aware of the perspective but disagree with it, but consider themselves to be from a political perspective, what would be your attitude towards those types of communities and leaders who are continue to propound feminism in the face of this issue?
I don't think I have a good answer to your question. Let's start with that. In other words, you didn't ask Akasha, you asked for help in the name of the Jewish community, so to speak. And I'm not sure I know how to provide that help. But I'll say a few things. One relates to something Rabbi Glau pointed out. You started right out by saying there are those who have this motivation and those who have that motivation. Right? Regardless of the motivation, whether lack of understanding is a kind of a motivation, right? Or an egalitarian hope without any understanding of what its implications are, or those who feel, well, there are more important things than tzniut. Shivyon is more important than tzniut. Equality, egalitarianism is more important than tzniut. That's what the second perspective. Try to understand that the second perspective is also one based on Yiras Shemayim. Mistaken. But it's based on Yiras Shemayim as well. It may not even be completely mistaken that beyond a certain point, Shivyon is more important than Tzniut, which is it's the halacha which sets that point and not any particular personal whim. We live within a context. All of us live within a context. We're affected by the way people think around us. If there's someone who feels that the ultimate issue in the world today is... there's a good case, there's a very good case to make that women are the most discriminated group of people on the planet. I think it's an excellent case. It's an excellent case. More than the blacks, more than the poor, more than the anybody. Of course, it's compounded when they're in some minority situation, the poor are not the minority, they're the majority, but so those who are concerned for women, for protecting women, are properly motivated. There's not something wrong with them. Now, a lack of understanding or capacity to realize that tzniut, and therefore, lahavdil. you'll be machal this example, Rabbi Glau. If two people are making a salary, right, and the boss of General Motors comes and says, I have to save money, I'm going to fire the one who's making more money as opposed to the one who's making less money, right? This would mean that making less money has an advantage, right? But this is not usually understood by most people, right? Most people are more interested in making the more money and not concerned about being fired and under those sorts of circumstances. Right? There's nothing practical about what I'm saying. It's just the notion that playing low, that keeping a low profile, that Nigidshma Avadshma, the greater your name, the harder it falls. That being in a humble, modest perspective is ultimately good for people also doesn't fit into the modern perspective. Now, how are you going to change that? I think it's near impossible. Especially within the Western context. Especially within the American Western context, where success is literally a value. It's a moral value. And the opportunity to get that success and its definition in terms of fame and publicity. I mean, what are movie stars, why are they considered successful? Look at the kind of lives they lead. Look at the kind of tzaras they have. Why is anyone looking up to them? But if not for the fact that fame seems to be more important than anything else. And this is the world we live in. If the most honored women are the ones who show off their body more than anybody else, if I'm not mistaken, women who do that in the films are much more famous and beloved on the community around them than women athletes, for example. And athletes, of course, are also highly regarded in Western society, right? So, and if we're all affected by this, then we don't stand a chance. You think rabbis are not affected by this? Rabbis are also affected by this. Shia Barur, I'm affected by this. To change the way we perceive things in a very basic way is, to say the least, extremely difficult. I mean, I like to quote Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. I used to think I would change the world, and then I thought I would only change my country, then I thought I would only change my village, and only my family. Now I can't even change myself. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And you're dealing with things that I don't deal with because it's not clear to me why female movie stars should be considered great people. In the Arab world, they are looked down upon, I believe. Go right ahead. It's not fair. It's not fair. I apologize. Arab women are treated horribly. The movie stars are also treated horribly. But it's self-imposed. I think that these kind of forums are as a way of putting across these ideas. And although I don't plan on sending Rabbi Blau and myself on international speaking tours, there's a certain dearth of appreciation for what's real in the contemporary Western world. And by working towards MS and trying to say what's true and trying to put across what's right in every possible way, we try to overcome that. And this is part of it, although if you feel a conversation with anyone in particular is likely to change things, then I'd be happy to have it.
Okay. I had a question.
Me?
Yes. So, if I understood what you said, one of the things you were saying was that at a certain point, the halakha is driven by essential differences between men and women. And when you get up to that point, you can't really move past that point ever. And it wouldn't even be wise to move past that point. That was what I understood. And I wanted to ask you about how to identify that point. I mean, in other words, when I look at, in secular society, I look at it kind of over the last couple hundred years, every time women have made any advance in terms of, I mean, if you had asked the arguments for why women shouldn't be in universities was they just don't have the natural capacity to do that. And then when they got there, there was an essentialist argument. They didn't have the natural capacity to go to law school or go to medical school. And I'm picking education as one example, but I think you could find this, the kind of essentialist narrative as a reason that women shouldn't push further is not a new thing. And so I'm wondering how, and at the same time, I don't think men and women are completely the same. I mean, so it seems that there is some, in various ways, different points on different issues. But I don't know how one would have any confidence about identifying those points. Since we seem to have been wrong in the past a bunch of times.
I understand you're not, you didn't ask what I'm about to answer. I'll try to answer also, or at least admit that I didn't. But the... I didn't say, and I know you didn't say that I said, that women do not have male capacities to do this, that, or anything. I don't believe that. You know, maybe individual women and individual men have and don't have all sorts of capacities, and I mean anything of the sort. In that sense, there's nothing that a woman shouldn't push to do if she wants to do it and if she thinks it's right to do, and that's not the issue over here. The question of when halakha may be dealing with the broad people as opposed to unique individuals, it would be as... I don't have to tell you that if someone has the capacity to appreciate fully God's creating the world without keeping Shabbos, he has to, in any case, even if all the other reasons for keeping Shabbos would not be part of the matter as well. What you did say was is that perhaps men have more capacity to, or perhaps this relationship which I described, and which I think is quite obvious, could be less pronounced up to a point. Well, I think that that's unlikely, and I certainly don't know where that point is. And the truth of the matter is, it's not only that that I don't know where that point is, it's that that point is different for me and for you and for Daniel, who's in my sight. I don't know where it is for each one of us. But I know what the halakha is for all of us. And that I have no reason to think that this halakha should be changed. I think everything around us, contrary to what Gary implied, and as I was pointing out at the time, indicates that the halakha is right. What's different in society around us is that the goals of society around us in terms of men-women's relationship is completely different than the goals of the Torah. And that what goes on in society around us results in the goals of the society, which are basically kept. The society is successful in what they want to do, which is, in this matter, virtually nothing. And the halakha, we are as successful as we are, despite society around us. And I do think that the kind of things that are going on in certain communities, certain Torah communities today, are an over-exaggeration of these concerns. I don't think it's coming out of... Well, I guess it's partially coming out of the fear of the outside world. But I think it's also coming out of a simple lack of coherence in terms of what's important and what's not important in the Torah. But the basic human interaction between men and women goes on all the time and everywhere. It goes on in the street, it goes on in the store, It goes on in the bus. It goes on wherever it goes on. No one's looking to change that. But there are moments b'kedusha where we should be left alone. And there are also roles which are perceived as being inappropriate within that context. And again, there's no way that I could have told you in advance what the halakha should be, this, that, and the other thing, if I didn't know already what it was. At the same time, I have no reason to think the halakha should be that anything has changed in society that would make these things any different. Yes, Danny.
I'm sorry if this is, pieces of this you might have answered already, but I'd like to ask what you then rather than. I ask a little bit more starkly maybe than anybody else has asked. Taking them at their words of worth, for those women who feel that their spirits were broken, the connection with Hashem is stifled in the way that traditional Judaism functions to it, they might be attracted to more problematic outlets for their spiritual selves. If we were to encourage institutions which are uniquely female or women's prayer groups, and this move towards women offering to soften any number of issues. I know that today, by and large, it's largely an issue in Nidah, but I also know that there's a move in that general direction.
Well, I didn't hear the last thing you said.
I'm aware that today that there's the by and large discussion of women offering to soften is in the area of
okay.
Nidah, but I'm aware that also that there's a growth in that general direction. How would we balance this with a fear of creating two Judaisms, or Judaism which looks too elastic, without allowing for greater leadership roles, which are often inherently public for women in the Jewish community?
I guess to take a cue out of Rabbi Schrader's book, I'm not sure I'm going to answer your question. But I would just like to put it in context. I'm not sure your question is a women's issues question. Meaning, any time there's a group that has a problem with some aspect of Judaism, you could ask the same question. But to what degree should you look for flexibility? To what degree should you draw more red lines? To what degree should you, how should you explain things to them? So I'm not sure I want to answer just because I think you have to put it in that context. I mean, it seems to me that's the same thing. There's a series of, whenever there's those kinds of challenges, people are bothered by some aspect of halakhic practice. So you'd ask a whole series of questions. You'd ask, what's motivating them? You ask, is there flexibility within our tradition? Do we have minority positions to rely upon? Would it cause other public policy problems if we do rely upon them? So I feel a little funny answering because I think I'm not so sure your question is a women's issue question unless you want to reformulate it.
I think this might be an exceptional case because in terms of halakha, I think it's fair to say that many people might view this as halakha has developed in a certain way to allow more opportunities for women, but at some point it seems to have gotten to a point, in some people's view, where it's as if people are saying, this far and no farther, that we will allow certain things, but we won't develop in any further direction.
Look, if that's your question, I would say that actually shows the health of the system, meaning we should do a lot to make people feel comfortable and make people feel like there are options, but if the system wouldn't have any red lines, it wouldn't be a very good system. Right, there has to be some point where what you believe in isn't just about making everybody happy and making everybody feel comfortable. Now, again, this doesn't mean you should say things in a rude way. It doesn't mean you should make fun of people. It doesn't mean you should criticize them in public necessarily. But the answer to every question can't be, since you feel bad, then the answer is yes. Right? At that point, we don't have a system. So again, I'm not suggesting that. I mean, most of my talk was arguing for elements of flexibility, but I don't think there could be an absolute push where anything that makes someone uncomfortable then has to change. Right?
You mentioned Rambam's statement about women who should be allowed to study the oral Torah if they're able to show themselves to be outside the Rov HaNashim. A, who decides whether they're outside of that Rov HaNashim? And B, is there any halakhic problem with a woman who shows equal competence in the Torah as a man being called a rabbi?
Okay. I assume the question's for me since I'm standing.
Yeah.
Okay. Just to be precise, I don't mean to be pedantic here, but the Rambam had the idea of Rov Nashim, meaning it's an inference in his words. And the Prisha makes that inference that shows that Rambam doesn't say anything about individual women being different. But it might be a reasonable inference in the Rambam's words that the Prisha makes. Look, I think the poskim that have been allowed or even encouraged women's learning basically seem to have argued that we're not going to do this on a woman-by-woman basis. They're just arguing that given the needs of contemporary women, that we could assume that a woman is, let's say, when... the truth might depend on the fact that the arguments are different, to be fair. I mean, the Bavitcher Rebbe is a very interesting piece, actually. Everyone should look at this. The Bavitcher Rebbe is a piece where he allows women to learn Gemara, which is quite fascinating because, as far as I know, I don't think there are too many Chabad school, high schools for girls where Gemara is on the curriculum. But Lubavitch Rebbe says that basically that women are going to be exposed to all kinds of secular disciplines, and their attachment to Torah will thereby be lessened if they're not exposed to the full intellectual depth of Torah. So if you make that kind of argument, I think there's no longer any need to kind of check on a woman-by-woman basis, have you left the Rove? I mean, there'd be a sense it's a different argument altogether. Even if you're going to make the argument based on the priesthood, it seems to me more that they're working with a working assumption about women in modernity, that they have, due to greater educational opportunities, they've revealed more intellectual ability than women had in the past, and therefore can be assumed to think be as part of that miyut, which is no longer a miyut. So that's what I would say. In terms of your second question, why they should be called rabbi, I would say as follows. I think we should have some term to indicate a learned woman. Okay, it need not necessarily be rabbi, but there should be some term. And I think I think it is a problem that there's no term for of recognition. I mean, how we're going to come up with a term is a good question. And anytime you innovate something, people often ridicule it initially. But I do think it's a problem that there are, again, there's less learned women in the community than men, but there are learned women doing very good things. And like I'll give you even simple example on a high school level. Like, let's say my wife and I were teaching in the same high school, right? So I would be Rabbi X and she would be Mrs. Y, right? So, but again, there's a certain respect engendered from having a title that Mrs. doesn't create that title. So what it's going to be, I don't know. But it seems to me it would be a reasonable thing that there'd be some term of recognition for a woman's achievements in learning. Ben?
I think you said about earlier about because there are the individual positions in halacha, allow some flexibility, or we can rely on them now. At what point do we say, okay, it's enough? Or do we say, okay, it's enough? Like, okay, there's whatever the situation is, one is the one vote, and I don't say vote, one vote position that everyone goes against, but that position would allow enough leniency for a particular context to say, at what point do we draw the line? Like, okay, now we have like women passing shaylos on certain issues. At what point do we say, also, why not this question, or why not this question, or not this question? Like, is there, why does it have to be that line at all? Like, you said there has to be red lines. Why? If there are positions, all the way to Rishonim, Machronim, all the way back to Gemara, maybe, why does that have to be? Is there something in value to having those positions?
Well, it seems you took more than one approach here, but I would say there have to be lines because there are, meaning there isn't unlimited flexibility in halacha.
There are certain situations that there might be a yakin on something.
Right, but that's even within that. Okay, so let's make the following category. There's certain things that there's no position and no precedent for. Right, so we'll agree that that's a red line. Is that okay? But then there are other things that there are minority positions to rely upon, and then there's a judgment call to be made. Now, I admit that requires serious judgment, which isn't easy. But I would just refer back to some of the factors I mentioned before, meaning when you're making that kind of judgment call, one thing involves is how great is the need? And I think, again, the greater the need, the greater the human concern, then the more reason there is to rely on those minority positions. When one feels that there's less of a need, now, again, obviously there's a certain subjective element and... look, but all decisions make good judgment in life. We need leaders with good judgment on these issues. There's no doubt that we're not going to make everybody happy all the time. And a woman could get up now and say that I'm totally wrong, and getting Aliyah is much more important than being exposed to Gemara. And again, I wouldn't be able to disprove her, but I think we need people with good judgments. There's no escaping that quality. But again, I think that's a much broader issue than a women's issue. I think, what? Look, some of it will...
Part of the natural development is something. Who's at the criteria of where the line gets drawn?
Look, wait, why wouldn't you... Let me ask the question. Wouldn't you ask me the same question if it wasn't about women in Judaism? You could say the same about any issue.
We can go across the board. We're talking this context, though, so...
Look, I would say as follows. You want someone who's... Okay, so I'll answer. You'd want someone who's quite learned. You'd want someone who's not just learned, but is a sensitive individual. You'd want someone who's been exposed to the broader community. And again, I think part of the problem with some of these questions is it's harder to answer what women are frustrated by and where women are feeling if you've never spoken to anybody. Right? I definitely think someone who's answered questions on this these kind of issues should have some exposure to the frustrated women out there. So I would say that it's like everything. But again, the flip side, of course, is you can be very psychologically sensitive and know the women, but if you don't know any Torah, it's also difficult to make these judgment calls. So again, part of the problem is this need for outstanding leadership. I think often there are individuals who have the kind of moral and sensitive qualities and knowledge that for the most part, the masses see them as someone they could talk to. And again, it could be we're living in a time that there's a dearth of good leadership like that. But I guess that brings us to another question, how to cultivate such leadership. But that's what I would say. Ben?
Could an argument made today that part of the need that arose for the women being able to ask these questions has come out of some sort of lacking within the Jewish community at large? Like, for example, there was a time there were plenty of stories in the Gemara, there's no lack of stories, but the Rebbeinu Gemara had questions like asking them that are rather personal and rather direct, and they dealt with them. And I've always presumed, maybe incorrectly, that because they were on a level where it's the Shema understood, and you have seen in the Shulchan Aruch are very explicit, and these things that are not, these aren't lacking, but it maybe it's a lack of the fact that on both sides, the men and the women, that things aren't because of the Shema enough anymore. And is that, therefore, people are uncomfortable on certain issues. That's the chisaron that's in the community today. And that's why we have, instead of addressing that, we found loopholes.
Sounds like the question's for Rabbi Schrader based on your example, is that correct?
Unfortunately, I had to deal with something, so I can't say if it was or wasn't.
I'm not sure why it's a question. Do you see why it would be a question what I said?
I can try to answer it, even if it's... It doesn't matter. I don't think it matters. I'm going to tell you something you all know. Most Jewish people are not observant today. When I say most, I mean in the United States, those who go by the title Orthodox by some or other standard is 10%. And those who are observant by yeshiva standards, I would say, is significantly less than that. Something wrong, Matitya? I got it. Okay. So if we got people out there who are concerned with keeping halakha, but aren't quite on the madrega that someone might hope for them, I'm happy that they're keeping halakha. I'm not going to sit around and think about whether it's lishma, whether it's not lishma, or how lishma it is. Baruch Hashem, someone asks a halacha question, it means they care enough. It means they're keeping the halacha. It means that they want to to do the right thing, or at least might want to do the right thing if they find out what it is. And mitoch shelo lishma, ba lishma. And if our generation is lacking in anything, then it doesn't start with people doing things shelo lishma. The Talmud would indicate that people always did things on some level shelo lishma, and that the hope had always been mitoch shelo lishma ba lishma. The question is just how to deal with it, and different dorot require different solutions to different problems. And of course, we have to remain within the context, as Rabbi Blau said on a number of occasions today and on other occasions, and in writing. I'll say something harsh. The rock bottom of what I just said, Binyamin, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether they're, we have to deal with them the way they are. Do we want them to stay the way they are? No. Do I want to stay the way I am? Also no. We all want to get closer to Hashem. We also want to be more al pi emes. But wherever anyone is, they have to be dealt with from where they are. And to give them mussar about whether their midos are right, or their ashkafos are right, the purity of their motivations are right, it's not likely to raise their motivations or to make them better in any way. We can tell them what we think their motivations ought to be. You know, they can either listen or not, but it's likely to be. It's we're not going to solve if. Yeah. Having said all that, I don't know. I don't know if you're right. The there are men. Forget women. There are men I know who said they once brought a shayla to a rav, Anuchas Nida. They'll never do it again. And I know the rav they went to, and he answers hundreds, thousands of shaylas for many, many people. And I've never heard of him being accused of being insensitive in this matter in any way. It wasn't the fact that the way he responded to the question that the person felt difficult with. It was simply the fact that he had to do it. Does that make this person who wants to keep Hilchos Nida proper, this man, lo lishma? I don't know. Do I want to help this man? Yes. Do I know how? No. Will women poskim or Yod Sot help this man? Maybe. Or it might help if his wife is willing to take on this responsibility instead of sending him to the Rav to do it. You know, I don't know. When women didn't want to confront the Rav, they sent their husband to do it. And if now the husband doesn't want to confront the Rav, for whatever reason, so the women, they can't, they're not interested in going in, they feel funny about it. Taras HaMishpacha has to be something that's encouraged in every possible way, and it's much more important than these kinds of details of who's going to answer the question. That the question is being asked is a davar gadol, and that everything has to be done to encourage that the questions be asked, and that people feel as comfortable as possible in asking them. It's very easy to criticize our generation. I'll tell you a story of my wife's friend. She went to yeshiva day school, and then yeshiva high school, and in 12th grade they had a class about halachot that they'll have to know when they're getting married, and they were taught Tarat HaMishpacha, and she was very, very upset that her parents had never kept Tarat HaMishpacha, which she, of course, knew as a fact, because how could it be that she was living at home and didn't keep Tarat HaMishpacha, and then wasn't aware of the fact that her parents were keeping Tarat HaMishpacha. And finally, her frustration grew to a level where she confronted her mother one day. How come you never kept Tarat HaMishpacha? And her mother screamed at her, what do you mean I never kept Tarat HaMishpacha? We don't talk about these things at home. We live in a tough door. We live in a generation, when I went to Yeshiva High School, it was a little bit before when Rabbi Blau did, the Rebbeim I had were foreign born. They didn't speak English all that well. They were wonderful people. They got a good run for their money from the class, let me tell you. I had a high school reunion recently, and it was like one fellow got up and said, if I had realized that Rebbeim had just been through the Holocaust, I would have treated them very differently. We didn't understand. We can't be ultimately critical of where the generation is. It's where it is. It's moving in all sorts of directions in a very confused way. And it's being affected by what's going on all around us. If for the past 3,000 years, feminism didn't exist or existed in a very minimal way, and in fact, the halakha, in terms of protecting women's rights, was certainly very much at the fore in in all matters of psak, both with ksuba and with many other ways. So, and now suddenly the world is in a context in which this is an issue. So had it been an issue in the world 500 years ago because the Mechaber and the Rama were alive, does that mean that it wouldn't have been a problem? I'm not so sure. They didn't have movies then. They didn't have television then. They didn't have universities then. They didn't have a lot of things that we know, and they knew a lot of things that we don't know. That's the truth of the matter also. And we have to focus on our generation the way it is and not try to... we can't just knock and say we should be like the way they used to be. We're not like the way they used to be. We're not going to be the way they used to be. It's the Chare Shemenu Kikedem has to be understood, and we need a stronger context. I hope I related properly to what you said. I just want to get back to Daniel, who I think was also asking me a question. Let me just make sure I got it right. Say it quickly again.
So I think like probably the question I wanted to ask you was not is how do we balance the fear that we have with the fear we might have about an incursion specific institutions specifically. And
I remember that.
We might be creating some kind of like double Judaism. If we don't do that, we might be creating a woman's Judaism and a man's Judaism, somehow splitting the community when it comes to spiritual matters, and even maybe when it comes to issues of Pesach, and when it balancing that with the, which seems like the only other option, which is that we allow greater leadership roles for women, which are inherently public.
I don't know, but the I'm not really worried that that's going to happen anymore. At least I guess, as Rabbi Blau implied, than has happened in many other ways. If there are different piskei halacha now in Haredi communities as opposed to non-Haredi communities, or as we habitually call them today, modern Orthodox communities, is that a schism? Or is it a reflection of different values? I mean, there's a different forum that we've dealt with already, but I'm sure it has to be dealt with again. Your assumption that psak coming out of women is going to be essentially different than psak coming out of men, I don't know why you're assuming that. It could be that you understand things that I don't, and I mean that. I mean, it could be I'm being very naive by what I'm saying right now. But the notion that they're going to be more machmir or more mekel, or as a rule, I suppose statistically that'll certainly be true, but the one way or another. But that that's going to have an ultimate impact on anything. I mean, my great grandfather went to the Gerer Rebbe. That was the spiritual leader. My great grandmother went to the Alexandria Rebbe because the Gerer Rebbe refused to receive women. Did they get different advice on different things in a conflicting way? I don't know. There are any number of households today where men go to one person for their shayla and their wives go to a different person for their shayla. I suppose that it creates conflict on some occasions, and I suppose each couple works it out the way they work it out. I have no idea what that might be, but I don't think there'll be an essentially different shita of psak that women develop than men. But if I'm wrong, so I'm wrong. And then, in terms of giving women leadership roles, which by their nature is public, I don't know. I know one thing. I am very confused. I don't know if you want to be very open about this. I am very confused about the role of rabbi in this generation. I'm very confused about the role of rabbinic authority. And I know I'm a rabbi, and I know I have a community, and I teach in yeshiva. And I'm confused. If there's someone who would know more than me but was technically not given that degree, the ordination, so to speak, what exactly is the significance of that? If there's someone who knows as much as me, what exactly is the significance of my ordination? Is ordination given in the context of Yeshivat HaMiftar for someone who studied a certain amount of Hilchot Shabbat, Hilchot Nidah, and Issa V'Heter? With the different levels of that means of those students, or it's not just Yeshivat HaMiftar, or if they in Yeshiva University they erred on the laws of slaughtering, and maybe you drop something else, and if somewhere else, say the curriculum is different, and if a great deal of the questions that rabbis have to deal with focus on aspects of halacha, let's say hilchot mezuzah and hilchot nidah, and the kind of things that you don't come out qualified to answer just from knowing the books, and hilchot brachot, and if the kashrus questions deal with can you rely on this hashkacha, as opposed to what happens when the spoon falls into the fleshik pot or whatever it is, And any number of times when I'm asked, can you rely on this hashgacha, I have absolutely no idea what to answer. Absolutely. And I don't mean only in America, where I'm not that familiar with hashgachas. I mean in Eretz Israel also. And why my having studied to be a rabbi and my further studies after having become a rabbi should make me qualified to answer what hashgacha you can rely on. It's not at all clear to me. I don't think there are too many other people who understand these things better than I do either. Maybe that's unfair. Maybe everyone else does, and it's just me who doesn't. But I don't think so. I don't think women and men who are looking for this title today quite understand what they're getting into. And I know I'm evading the question of should we give women ordination, which I feel I have a right to evade because I don't give anybody ordination. So to make up a title for women who know more, certainly women who know more, as well as men who know more, without the title, should certainly be given proper recognition. How to do it in a meaningful way, again, I have no idea. But, and I don't have hope. I'm sorry, and this relates to Avram Pesach's question, Daniel's question before. I don't really know how to resolve the real problems of the rabbinate. As opposed to what I think is a secondary question of how to deal with women leadership. There are going to be women leaders on one or another level. There are already. They're continuing to grow. To the best of my understanding, it's happening within its Tzanua context. I don't see it as being in violation of it. But the issue of the rabbinate in particular, and we just had in the news recently, I'm sure you've all heard, that the president of Israel has refused to call a non-Orthodox rabbi but the title rabbi. The reaction, and I don't want to call it an overreaction to that fact, assumes a tremendous amount of what being a rabbi means that is unclear to me. The reverence with which this the studying that this 24 or 25 year old who gets this ordination. The smicha, what it means, and the reverence with which he should be taken as a result of that is, I think, not properly evaluated. The curriculum is not very clear to me. The expectations are not very clear to me. The lack of real on-the-job training, which may be changing, but which is certainly the case, is also very clear to me. The need to understand from within how to answer questions. You know, I happen to have been a rabbi of an agricultural settlement for 4 years. And as a result, perforce had to become aware of certain things. Someone from Efrat called me up with an agricultural question of his garden and not his farm. And when I related to the question, he told me that he spoke to several, he didn't mention any names, but several rabbinic authorities who couldn't relate to the question at all. If you don't know what's going on, you can't deal with it. The same is certainly true of Hilchos Nida, and women are at a very specific advantage in being able to deal with those questions beyond a shadow of a doubt compared with many men. No doubt many Rabbanim as well. I once sat in the class, and it goes back 20-something years in America. It must be 26 years ago, and Rabbi Tendler, in the class with Rabbi Tendler, sitting with Rabbanim, twice my age, who said, in the class, point blank, now they're suddenly getting questions, relates to Binyamin's point. Now we're suddenly getting questions, and he never got before in his life. People who are covered with it, he doesn't know what to do with it, Bichla. Basic understanding of simple matters. You want to deal with electricity. You see what Reb Shlomo Zalman, how he worked on electricity, how well he understood electricity, how he knew it, how he thought so carefully about application. How many of us have expertise in anything? You know, if someone asks you, are you allowed to turn a car off when you drive to a hospital for pikuach nefesh reasons, or do you have to let it running? So how many of you understand, just if by a show of hands, it's nothing to be proud of or embarrassed of, how many of you understand what the technical implications of turning a car, the ignition off, is in terms of what that means about the fire? I see one hand, two hands, three hands, four hands. I want you to know, I believe the four of you, and I believe the rest of you also. Now, how many Rabbanim understand anything about car mechanics to answer the question? And unless they want to say what it says in Shemirat Shabbat Kilchata, okay, that's perfectly legitimate, by the way. But, you know, if it says one thing on the top of the page and something else on the bottom, if you have any criteria to be able to evaluate one against the other, then, or if you don't, then what are you dealing with? So you learn Hilchos Shabbos. So you know Ovel HaMetes Melachos. So, but if you don't know how a car works, how are you going to answer the question? Now, if a woman happens to know how a car works, which she might, at least as well as or better than the majority here who didn't raise their hands, of course she has a better chance of getting the right answer than if she knows a little bit about Hilchos Shabbos, a drop about grammar, you know. You can talk about something. Too much is being packed into that term rabbi. Too much. And it's not just here. I mean, a few years ago I spoke to the Kol Elyon in Yeshiva University. They were learning Shavuos. The Shavuos is something I had to deal with on a practical level. The Rosh Yeshiva was sitting there in awe of me. And it's not that they knew the Mishnayos and the Yerushalmi not as well as I do. They knew it better, probably. But that the question of what Gidush Shlish is a halacha and a zera or an esef as a real issue was something that was beyond them. They'd never thought about the reality has to be understood to deal with the world. Women are approximately half the people in the world. They are different than men. Hilchus Nida gives halachic great significance to that difference. They're different than men in other ways too. We need women who understand women well from within to deal with things. That's all. It's not an issue bichlal. You can't not talk to them. You cannot relate to them. You cannot have them, as a result of that, taking on leadership positions in one way or another. But in the issue of tzniut, is an issue that we're going to have to deal with. And I don't have the exact answer, the exact line. But you can't put your head in the ground and expect to know what's going on above the surface of the earth. Are there any other questions for Rabbi Blau and myself?